What? So welcome everyone to the group chat. I'm so excited to speak to everybody again. And today I have a very special guest. So I first met Zhihui sometime last year, and honestly, the conversation went so well and was so excited to bring her on board as our English and GP tutor. But enough from me, maybe I'll just let Zhihui introduce herself.
Okay, so I clearly met Daryl last year. I was also very excited to speak to him. Some background for myself. I have been teaching for 10 years or so. I've been teaching since 2014. I was at the Learning Lab for quite a while, and I needed a break just around that time. Ran into Daryl, who convinced me to join Overmouth. So I'm very excited to be here, excited to be on this podcast, excited to share with you what I think are some tips and tricks for doing well at general paper.
Yeah, I mean, GP is a subject that every single JC student have to take. I remember when I was a student, I really struggled, especially the transition from O-level English to GP. Specifically for me, GP was important because the course that I wanted to required me to get a B, but I've never gotten anywhere higher than a D throughout my entire JC life. So it was actually very stressful. I tried many ways to improve on my GP, like reading up and, like doing more practices, but I didn't see like significant improvement. So I hope that if you're a student that is like me in the past, whereby you're really struggling to move your GP grade to an A, today's podcast is meant to really help you understand deeply how you can achieve that. So maybe, Zhihui, what we can start with is to talk about the nature of general paper. So perhaps can we better understand sort of like the components, how much do we need to score, and what exactly is like Cambridge looking for when they say this student is an A grade kind of GP student?
Okay, so I think it's interesting that you started by telling me about feeling like there was a jump from the O levels to GP. Because you're correct, there is. Okay. I think a lot of the students whom I get who struggle tend to feel that although it seems like the same subject, right, it's substantially harder. So for any, I think actually by now most JC1s should have sort of settled into the rhythm of it, but just to give you guys a sense, there are two papers, right, for general paper, as opposed to the O levels where you have the orals and the listening as well. General paper has only two papers. There's paper one, which is the essay paper, and there's paper two, which is the sort of comprehension, short answer question type of paper. For paper one, the difficult thing is it's purely argumentative essays. And so that's a jump from O-level students who may have chosen to write descriptive or maybe even personal recount essays. So the level of rigor that is required is much higher. I think another thing that takes students by surprise is that at the O-levels, content is 10 and language is 20, right? So the weightage of the paper is more towards language than it is towards content. But in GP, content is 30, language is 20. So I want here to start by debunking this myth, right? Which is that you don't have to study for GP. That's not true, okay? Right? You've got to study for GP because if you don't have content, if you don't know anything about the world, then you can't say anything logical or sensible. Then your content score is forever doomed to sit at the 14, 15 mark. You know, all student can talk about the general content, the general topic, right? But it's not specific. So that's the first thing. For paper one, I think a lot of students struggle because they don't realize that the content load, the knowledge required to score well is substantial. And I'll talk more about this later. For paper two, right, you have the compre, the summary, and the AQ, right? Of these three, compre and summary will be familiar to the O-level students. You're like, okay, I know that, right? I've done this before. But the style of question also becomes harder. The requirement for answering also becomes harder. So the strategies that you may have relied on to get yourself through the O-levels probably won't work at the JC level lah, right? And I think this is especially true for summary, which I will also talk about later. Okay, the last thing that students really struggle with for general paper is the application question, right? The AQ, which is a totally new component. I do think it is very difficult. Part of why it's difficult is because each paper you only get 1.5 hours, right? So the AQ is kind of like a very mini essay, but you have to cram it into like half an hour, which I think a lot of students really struggle with. It doesn't help to me, lah. This is just my point of view. It doesn't help that some schools only start teaching it later in the year, right? So some of you who are listening may actually be thinking, oh, my school just started, right? Or my school actually hasn't really given us a lot of AQ practice. I think this is a mistake, lah. Okay. For me, students who have joined me earlier in the year will know that actually bang at the start of the year, we begin with the AQ because actually I think it takes a lot of time for students even to get used to the format of the answer. So students who have been with me since the start of the year in like March, February, right? Only now are we starting to really think about nuances. How can we make this good, right? From March until now, right? From March until June, I've really been teaching. This is just how to answer, okay? This is just the steps you need to go through. So, the AQ does take practice to answer in such a short time frame. So, please practice. Very important. And I'll talk about the specific, answer style that is most effective for the AQ later. Okay. How much to score minimally for an A? I think all students know that the score fluctuates a little bit. Year, right? Is it difficult? Is it not? But more or less, it's the standard A grade, right? Aim for 70, right? 70 plus, and you're good, right? You're golden. Make sense? What was your last question? I feel like you asked something else here.
It's like more of like, what makes a GP student like A grade? Like what is like the difference? I think you alluded to
Oh,
it yourself, but
okay.
what
Yes, 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 yes.
characteristics,
That's right.
will we look from there?
Okay. So the first thing, the most important thing is read the question. Okay, then you're like, oh my God, duh, right? Why is she saying this? It's when I say read the question, I mean that you really need to pause before you start writing and ask yourself, what are the tricky terms in this question, right? So for instance, paper one, okay, say you do a question like, can social media bring about genuine change? Okay, a lot of students think I can do this question, right? Because yes, I know about social media. I'm on TikTok, doom scrolling all the time, right? Like I use Instagram, right? So okay, I have some background knowledge on social media. Can social media bring about change? Maybe you even think, yeah, I have some examples, right? Campaigns, fundraising, all this sort of thing. But actually, the trick in the question is whether you address the word genuine change, right? And paper one requires you to think about how would you define genuine change? What is a real change versus what is a fake change, right? And if you don't talk about that, you'll never get an A, right? Like you are immediately locked out of an A, right? The examiner is just not going to move you into that band because it shows an incomplete grasp of the question. So at this point, right, all of you at home are now thinking, crap, what is genuine change? How do I define genuine change? Okay, the first thing is a lot of students will just try and give me paraphrases, right? They'll say things like, genuine change is real change, or genuine change is true change, right? And I'm like, okay, but what is true change or real change, right? When you define, you cannot define by swapping out the word. Right? You have to give more explanation. So, the example I use in class with my students is okay, say my boyfriend complains my house very untidy, right? Why you like that, right? And then, is it real change if I say, okay, I clean up, right? Then I clean up, but next week is untidy again. What do you think, Daryl? Is that real change?
No,
I
I
clean up
mean
this week, but next week is a mess again.
it's just to placate, right? So I guess the word here is genuine, right?
Correct. Yes, correct. So one definition of genuine is this change lasting, right? Is it permanent? Is it something that holds in the long term? And you can kind of already see this when you think about social media. The change that social media tends to bring about usually is not lasting, right? Because the nature of social media is that it's always about the next trend, right? It's always about the next viral thing that the algorithm serves to you. So A sophisticated student, an A grade student, will be able to understand and say, hey, social media can bring about some changes, but often these changes are not concrete. They are not long lasting. Therefore, I don't think this is real change, right? Similarly, we go back to the my house is untidy example. Boyfriend complained, voila, why are you still like that? Then I say, okay, never mind. I'm going to hire a cleaning lady, right? Okay, satisfied, right? Is that real change? Again, the answer is no, right? Exactly. It's not real change because I am the problem, correct? Right? The house is clean, but the real problem that my boyfriend is trying to identify is I am untidy. Does that make sense, right? So again, an A grade student will perhaps be able to argue social media can raise awareness, but it doesn't get at the root of the problem, right? The root cause of the problem is X, whatever X is, right? Whatever you example you've chosen to pick out, right? So the same way that you would say, okay, if I hire a cleaning lady, it's not real change because the root of the problem is I'm an untidy person and my boyfriend doesn't like that. Same thing with social media, right? If you say social media, can it solve discrimination? You might say, okay, Black Lives Matter, there was a raising of awareness, but at the end of the day, discrimination is very deeply rooted in our human psychology or something like that. Does that make sense? Yeah, so that's the first thing, right? The first thing that coming all the way back to the original question, which is what makes you an A student, is really about your insight into the tricky keywords in the question, which I will say most people want questions have, right? There will always be something there that is designed to make you think harder. And frankly, okay, this is going to be a bit controversial, but I think the O levels doesn't teach you to do that. The O levels just gets you to write a very superficial essay. So at the A levels, there's this big step up, which is a bit difficult for most students. Okay. The other thing is the rubric itself will say relevant and wide-ranging examples. Okay. A wide-ranging, relevant, Okay. So this comes back to the original idea, which is that you need to study. You need to have some sense of the world around you. If you don't, dun, 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 right, then you're going to be in trouble. And I'll talk about this more when it comes to examples when we talk about paper one. The last thing to bear in mind is your writing should be error-free and elegant. Really, I swear, okay? Because again, language is a component of both paper one and paper two. Paper one, language is 20 out of 50. Paper two, language is 15 out of 50. A lot of Singaporean students, all the way up to the A levels, you continue to make pretty basic errors. So errors of tenses, right? Your grasp of the past tense and present tense is still a bit wobbly. Sometimes your subject-verb agreement. A lot of students will do things like say, oh, the author say that, da 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 da. But we all know, I think it's quite basic, that it should be the author says that, right? The same way that you say, a dog eats meat, right? One dog eats, right? The verb takes an S, right? Or you say dogs eat meat, right? So plural dogs, there's no S on the verb, they eat meat. So it's the same thing, right? The author says, one author says that something, 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 something. So a lot of students are like, Miss Ho, does it really matter? You understand what I'm trying to say, right? I understand. But you want an A, correct? Right? If you want an A, I then work on these small things. They count, right? Because they if you consistently make this error, actually it suggests to your examiner that you don't have a grasp of this basic grammar rule. So then you're in trouble, right? Similarly, try and write elegantly, try and write naturally. What do I mean by that? I think a lot of Singaporean students, again, this may be bad training from schools or whatever, but you write in a very formulaic manner. So a lot of questions in paper one will say, oh, okay, I just gave this to my students, right? The arts are irrelevant to our daily lives. To what extent is this true of your society? A lot of students will simply take the question phrasing and then say to a small extent or to a large extent, right? So you get funny stands that come out like, the arts are irrelevant to our daily lives in Singapore to a small extent. What is irrelevant to a small extent? If you think about it logically, irrelevant to a small extent means I think they are relevant, right? Yeah, then can you just say that, right? Can you just say I think the arts are largely relevant to our daily lives? What on earth is irrelevant to a small extent? I hate that. I cannot stand it. Or if any of my students are listening to this podcast, they will know, right? 100%. Miss Ho hates the phrasing to a large extent, to a small extent, right? And I especially hate to a certain extent because what is a certain extent doesn't mean anything, all right? So I was very pissed about that. Please, you can just write naturally, say, hey, I think the arts are largely relevant. I think the arts have significant relevance. I think, or you can write, I think most people find the arts mostly irrelevant. These are just much more natural ways of saying it than irrelevant to a small extent. Okay, very good. Yeah, so those are, again, let me repeat, right? Three things. One, insight into the what the question is really asking you about. So you want to ask yourself, okay, is it genuine change? Relevant and wide-ranging examples. I'll talk about this later. And your writing should be error-free, right? As much as possible. And it should strive to sound natural and elegant. Cool.
Wow, sounds easy and hard at the same time. I remember this like certain extent thing. I got like bombed so hard when I write it because it's like no, not here, not there. But thanks a lot for offering the
Yeah.
insights. But you see, I think a lot of students when we first approached GP, when I was a student, like nobody told me this lah, right? Everybody tell me only read more newspaper, listen to the news, but not broken down to the granular extent to help us understand what is required if you want to do well in GP. Anyway, thanks a lot for sharing, Joey. We'll go for a short ad break and we'll be right back. Okay, so Joey, at the first part, right, we talked about GP overall, like the components of the paper, how we look to approach each of them. Now I really want to deep go very deep into each of the paper. So let's start with paper one. So paper one is essay based and there's a few questions to choose from, right? So naturally, one of the questions I would need to ask you is, as a student, how do I select the right question? And is there a specific structure for paper one?
Got confirmed. Okay, so the first thing is how do I pick the right question, right? Right now, the new syllabus has reduced the number of questions. So for the bulk of my teaching career, actually, it was 12 questions, choose one, correct? Now it is 8 questions, choose one. Okay, if you go to the syllabus document is very dear to my heart. I always look at the syllabus document because to me that's like fundamental, right? You will find that the syllabus document actually lists a number of topics that you can study, right? So for instance, the classic ones are science and technology. You have the arts, right, which my students have just finished going through. We have the environment, we have society and culture, da 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 da. Okay, so you can go and look at the syllabus document. That's the first thing. Now, the other thing is, please don't say I will choose to study one topic only and I'll just spot that and let it go. The other thing I want to tell you is any tuition center, any teacher who thinks they can spot topics, right, is lying. Okay. I have never, ever once in my life told students I think I can spot this topic because frankly, you never know, right? Sometimes you are lucky, right? And the question that you guess does come out. Sometimes you're not, right? So it's just please study three topics, right? And that will give you coverage just in case the topic that you spot, a difficult question comes out, you decide, hey, I'm not going to do this. I'm going to do one of my other topics instead. What do I mean by this? I mean that, say for instance, right, a lot of students think science and technology is always very popular. Why? Because a lot of you are science students, correct? So you think to yourself, okay, I am a science student, therefore I should study the science and technology topic for GP. But I think that's dangerous. The reason being, sometimes science and technology comes up with some pretty niche questions. Okay. And an example of this, there was 1 year, really, I still trauma. Okay. 1 year, the question was, I think something like, to what extent can spending on space research be justified? Dun, 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 dun. Right. Even as a teacher, I don't think I have a lot of knowledge on space research. Okay. So and I can tell you quite honestly that you're talking to my friends in junior who are teaching in junior colleges, right? Nobody spotted that. Nobody will spot, oh, space research is going to be tested, right? So unless you happen to be a student who is just very interested in space for whatever reason, you won't have enough content knowledge to do that. And students who say to themselves, okay, but I studied science and tech, so I must do this, right? You bomb that year lah, right? So instead of just spotting one topic and saying, okay, I'm just gonna pray, right, that it comes out, please study a range of topics so that if you get a funny question like to what extent should we spend on space research, then you can at least say, okay, I'm not gonna do this topic, I'm gonna do something else, you see? So that's the first thing. The other thing is, so okay, you imagine, okay, I've done as Ms. Ho has said. I've studied three topics. I studied science and tech, and I studied the environment, and I studied society and culture. Okay, I go into the exam, I open the paper, right? And I see these 8 questions. What do I do? Okay, the first thing, of course, is eliminate the topics that you didn't study, right? You know, you strike out, okay, here's one question on the arts, right? I don't know anything about the arts, just delete, right? I don't have the information to write about this, okay? But say, okay, after I've done that process of elimination, I still have maybe another 3 or 4 questions, okay? What should I do at that point? That point, what you really want to do is check that you understand, as I said just now, any tricky terms in the question, okay? Look for, you know, the crux keywords, words like real social change or more than the past, any of these tricky terms, and you see if you can deal with those, right? Ask yourself, can I really define this? What is this question really asking me? Once you've done that, please plan your essay thoroughly, right? Lay out all the arguments first before you start writing. I think a lot of another error that a lot of students make is they think, oh crap, I have no time, I have to start writing, right? Then I see your when my own students give me their school papers, right? I look at their planning, then it will be a few little squiggles, right? A little arrow, maybe a word here, a word there. Look, even until today, I still plan essays when I teach them in class, right? I still write them down and plan. You also need to plan. And what I mean by plan is I really mean you lay out your body paragraphs, right? You should know exactly what point you're going to cover in every body paragraph, and you should know exactly what example you are going to use for every body paragraph in advance, so that when you start writing, you are simply delivering all the thoughts that you've already laid out in your head, as opposed to I write and think at the same time. Every one paragraph, then I pause and I think of the next paragraph. I pause and I think of the next paragraph. That will actually take you longer. I swear, I promise, cross my heart, hope to die. Okay? So, how I teach GP in classes is that for every topic, we collate, or I collate, right, all the last 10 years worth of questions from that topic. And I ask my students, what are some common ideas that come up in that particular topic? Okay, so for instance, right, in science and technology, across the last decade of questions, 2014 to 2024, a lot of the questions are really about, can science save us from problem X, where problem X is something, right? One year the question was, science is the only answer, science is the only answer to global hunger, right? So in that case, global hunger is X. That was quite difficult, because I think a lot of students don't think about global hunger, right? Okay. Last year, the question was, to what extent can science and technology solve the problem of waste disposal? So X is waste disposal, right? But the overall theme or the overall question that keeps getting repeated is, can science save us from X? Right? Whatever X is. So you imagine you go in, you sit down, you open the paper, and you see a question that says, can science save us from global warming? Right? Very typical question. At this point, you want to ask yourself, okay, great, right? What does it mean to save us from this? Right? What is the extent of being saved? And in class with me, what I do with students is, okay, we go through the arguments for can science save us from X, right? what are the general capacities of science? So you can say science is innovative, right? Science is something that's very empirically based. As such, science can save us from all kinds of problems because scientific solutions are designed in such a manner that if they don't work, we throw them away and we try something else, right? So that's in favor of science. But what are some of the arguments against science? Arguments against science, expensive, hard to implement, right? The root cause of the problem is not solved, right? The governments are kind of unequal, right? You might get mainstream distrust of science. So you take all of these general arguments, master arguments, and you apply it to the question whatever X is, right? So again, in this essay, I would expect you to say, okay, what are some ways in which science can save us from global warming by providing us with concrete technical solutions? And then you give me all your examples. But what's the problem? Well, you can argue that really at the heart, global warming is because it happens because of bad individual decisions, or it's because companies seek to increase profit. Or you can argue that even if science comes out with the solution, governments or countries are not willing to implement it. You can argue that part of the problem that science cannot solve is that some people don't believe that climate change is happening, right? So there's a distrust of science. So the idea here is if you study with me, what I will do is I'll give you these general arguments. We work them out together in class. And then in the exam, you must be able to see that the general argument applies to the specific question, right? Because the specific question X can be anything. I cannot guarantee what X is going to be. Then that's up to you to apply from there to from what we've talked about in class to the paper itself. Make sense, right? So the last thing for paper one that I want to highlight is when you think about structure for paper one, it's very straightforward, right? Intro, 2 to 3 body paragraphs, counter argument, rebuttal, conclusion. Your school should teach you this, right? There's no secret sauce here. It's just how it is, okay? Within every body paragraph, it's the standard thing, it's peel, okay? The order of CA, rebuttal, body paragraphs, frankly, I don't care. Some schools will say you should do body paragraph, CA, rebuttal. Some schools will say you can CA, rebut, body paragraph. Some people will say CA, rebut, body paragraph, body paragraph, body paragraph. I don't care, right? Like, it doesn't matter. The internal organization of it's really up to you, whatever you feel comfortable with. But if it's so simple, why do students present such variance in scores, right? Why is it that, like, oh, it's we all know this, right? Body paragraph, PEEL, why? The main thing actually is that your examples and elaboration vary significantly in terms of quality, okay? Quantity sometimes as well. Some students just have nothing to say, but quality more than anything else. So I give you guys a very concrete example, okay? We think about how can science and tech save us from global warming lah? Okay, so say for instance, the student wants to argue that yes, science and tech can save us from global warming because technology provides concrete solutions to the problem of global warming. Okay. A very weak student will say, yes, technology can provide solutions to global warming. For instance, right, air conditioning can help keep people cool, right? So long as we have air conditioning, global warming will not be a problem because we can just stay indoors and enjoy the air conditioning. And then the example will be like, oh, Singapore is very heavily air conditioned. Most families have one. There's always a shopping mall where you can go into to escape the heat. I'm sad to say this student does not pass. Okay, you don't pass because it's a failure to understand what the question is really talking about when you talk about save us from global warming, right? Save us from global warming doesn't apply in the very sort of individual, okay, so long as I have aircon, I won't be affected, right? Really, the question is asking, can global warming as a geopolitical problem, as a significant global problem, can that be solved by science and technology? So if you speak on the level of I have aircon, so it'll be fine. You're screwed. Okay? Cooked. Crickets. Okay. Okay, so we move one level up from that. Okay, so I'm very sorry, okay. If you were thinking, oh shit, I would have written that, right? Never mind. Can still fix it. There's still time. All right. A still weak student will say, okay, technology can provide solutions to the problem. Let's look at air conditioning. Still air con, okay. But you can say that, hey, you know, we removed chlorofluorocarbons, right, CFCs, right, from air conditioning. And that shows that we can tackle problems like healing the ozone layer through science and technology. This was widely adopted. Now all air cons are CFC free. So, you know, we can keep people cool while dealing with, you know, the problem of weakening the ozone layer. Okay. This student, depending on how good their language skills are, is still at the borderline, by the way. All right. This is a maybe a barely pa E lah, all right. We call it subpass. Okay. If your school is strict or if your language is bad, you're still screwed. Okay. You're still under par. Because, man, it's not a very sophisticated example, okay? Right? We're still talking about air conditioners. The depth of analysis is still not good, you see, right? So, okay. Okay, finally, we're into the pass zone, right? Into the clear pass zone. A good student will say, look, technology can save us from global warming because it is a force that can provide significant solutions on a wide scale, right? And that includes things like solar, wind, renewable energies. For instance, solar farms in Scotland, right? China is also building enormous solar farms. You can talk about things like making our day-to-day technology more efficient. You can talk about electric cars. Okay, so you see, the level of example is leveling up, right? The argument is still the same, by the way, right? I've not changed the argument. The argument is still technology can give us solutions. But the level of examples and the level of analysis is rising. And as the level of examples and level of analysis rises, so does your score lah. Okay, so now we're into the pass zone. Congratulations. Okay, so what will an A grade student say? Okay, first things first, the A grade student will address the question of being saved in more detail, right? So not only will the A grade student say technology can give us solutions, that student will elaborate on why science and tech offers good solutions or the best solutions, right, to save us from the problem. So I will look out for words like science and tech offers us significant solutions that can be implemented in time to save us from global warming. Because one of the key problems of global warming is that the clock is ticking, correct? Right? You know, there's all this alarm about how if we don't change our ways in the next 50 years, we're cooked, right? Literally cooked. So a grade A student will say, look, science and tech can save us because the change that science and tech can bring about will happen quickly enough to deal with this problem, right? It will be on a large enough scale and it will be quick. It will be easily adopted, therefore, it can save us. So you see, the level of analysis has gone up significantly here, right? Furthermore, what are some examples you can give? They can talk about the improvement in size and capacity of lithium-ion batteries, which is all the stuff that's in your power bank, in your electric vehicles, such that solar energy is becoming more cost-effective, right? So you gather all the solar energy, you need storage, right? As lithium-ion battery technology improves, then you get a jump, right, in the cost-effectiveness of such science and tech, right? And you see, again, this student is not only giving me a more sophisticated example, this student is linking it to the adoptability of this kind of technology, right? You can also talk about things like how large-scale solutions like geoengineering, right, changing perhaps something about the Earth's atmosphere, are being trialed in order to see whether, you know, this is something that can be done on a planet-wide scale. Right? So, see, this is what I mean, right? We started out at air cons will keep us cool, okay? And at the A grade rank, we ended with, look, you know, lithium ion, geoengineering, these are all things that really help us address the problem in a safe and timely manner. Ah, there we go. That's the range of fail to A grade. Okay. Ah, so you ask yourself now, where are you on this line? Okay. Frankly, I think most students are not at a grade A lah. Okay. But you can get there. It's just a question of A, learning enough about a topic. That's why, you know, if you want to study science and technology, you cannot just say I'm a science and tech student, so it's fine. You need to study what are recent developments in environmental science or in science and technology. Okay. You need to look for example, don't just read the newspapers on a general basis, right? So for instance, I always tell my students, if you want to do science and technology as a topic, you go to the MIT Technology Review. Right, you go to this specific website. Every year they do like a top 10, top 20, like new emerging technologies. Firstly, I think it's very interesting. Okay. Secondly, I think obviously they are a dedicated source, right? So they produce, you know, high quality, understandable information. Right? So that's where you get, you know, more knowledge. And then, of course, as I said, how do you score well for insight into the question? Really think about what does it mean for science and technology to save us, right? The timeliness, the depth of the answer, so on and so forth. This one you come to class, we analyze together. That's all I have to say for paper one.
Why nobody tell me this last time?
I
I feel, no, I
don't know, my
genuinely
teachers told
feel,
me this.
yeah, I know, I genuinely feel that a lot of students are stuck in the middle. Like I know, okay, to be very honest, I think listeners here wouldn't be writing the, oh, I got aircon and I'll be safe from global warming. I don't think many will go
Correct.
to that stage, but I don't think many understand the level or the extent of information and insights and examples you need to have to really hit the higher tier. I think indirectly, you also addressed one of the follow-up questions that I had, which
Yeah,
was
so correct.
how
So
do we
most
integrate
students,
examples, right?
correct. So most students are at B and C because most students will tell me, look, you know, technology can bring significant solutions like wind and other renewable powers. Right, that's the tier below lithium ion batteries, geoengineering, timeliness of the solution. But then you'll be stuck at a C lah, right? How many of you know, in your content score, your teacher gives you 16, 17, that's where you are, right? 16, 17, maybe, you know, and then your language mark, depending on, again, your level of error, right? Your level of vocabulary, you get another maybe 12 marks, right? 12 is pretty typical. Then 16 plus 12, 28 lah. That's it. That's where you are. You're stuck at a C.
I mean, for me, I think one big thing here is you really need the content knowledge. I feel like without that, it's very hard to push to go far because you don't you can't really yap about these kind of things, right? It's concrete. You need to actually know the details and the strategy to approach on
Yes.
how to discuss it as well. Yeah, but I think another monster is definitely paper two. I actually think paper two
Correct.
is
Yep.
harder to improve than paper one. So perhaps maybe Joey, could you like go more in depth into like some of the common traps in comprehension summary as well. For me, I have never scored more than like 3 marks for AQ. So how do we tackle that as well?
Oh no. Okay. So paper two divides into three sections, right? You have the short answer question types, you have the summary, you have the AQ. Okay. When it comes to comprehension, a lot of schools will tell students to think about question types. Okay, this is a pretty O-level approach as well. And your school may have different names for this, but the standard names that are usually put around are, is the question a direct question, right? So you source and paraphrase. Is it an inference question? So do you have to guess something or make a logical guess about something? You get a lot of language questions, right? And then some schools have a damn long chapalang list of types of questions, punctuation lah, irony lah, technique lah, so on and so forth. That's not wrong, okay? I don't want to say that's wrong, but students, to me, sometimes get bogged down by trying to identify what is the question type, right? They'll ask things like, Ms. Ho, what are the keywords for direct questions? Frankly, the question phrasing changes, right? We see that year after year, Cambridge alters the question, right? So as to trap students lah, really. Okay. If from the start of when I started teaching till now, I think the question style has evolved significantly. So instead of being fixated very blindly on what kind of question type is this, generally I tell my students, understanding any passage is about trying to think about two things, right? What is the author saying, and how is the author saying it? Okay. Frankly, this is true even in daily life. Okay. I think all of communication is what is being said and how is it being said, right? So, say for instance, what's a good example? What's a good funny? Okay, classic. Okay, this is a bit stereotypical, but say Daryl, in your case, okay, say somebody's say your wife or your wife, right? Your wife says to you, Daryl, are you hungry? Then you say no. Then she says, really, you're not hungry, Okay lah. What's she really saying?
It's the subtext, right? So when
Yes,
she say
correct.
she
What's
asks me if hungry, it's like she wants to eat, man. It's not about me, man.
correct, very good, right? So the you see, what is being said? Okay, level one is the level of the words themselves, right? So level one of what is your wife saying is she's asking me if I am hungry, right? And then you just paraphrase, she's asking me if my stomach is empty, or she's asking me if I would like to eat something. Level one. But as a husband, you know, level two is actually, I'm hungry, right? I want to eat something. Okay. Level three is how it is being said. How it's being said is she's hinting at her own hunger, right? She's using a question to you, right? To suggest that she herself is hungry, right? So even in a day-to-day example, actually, I think a lot of students instinctively, you know this, right? You know that when something is said, there may be a secondary layer of meaning, and the way that it is being said influences how you receive the message, right? So for instance, you know, your wife says, okay lah, right? And she does it in a very exasperated tone of voice. That's a how as well, right? How does she convey, actually, I'm hungry. Okay, so another example that perhaps some of the students who have come to my June crash courses will know, some of my students in class who have been with me, they'll also have heard me say this. Say for instance, the teacher comes to you and then looks at, you know, your study schedule and says, oh, so and so, your method of studying is very unusual. Okay, level one is you source and paraphrase, right? This is a direct question in your school's terms, okay? You will just say, oh, the teacher means that my method of studying is not typical, okay? But level two, there's usually some meaning behind that. There may be, right? If a teacher tells you your method of studying is unusual, what is the teacher really trying to tell you? What do you think, Daryl? You go to a student and say, hey, your method of studying is very unusual.
It's like saying it's not good or not optimized, I guess.
Correct. Yeah, exactly, right? You're probably implying, hey, you know, your method of studying actually should be changed, right? It's not correct. It's not good. And the technique involved is this is a euphemism, right? It's a roundabout way of saying things because you don't want to hurt this student's feelings, right? You don't want to go up to the student and say, why you study like that? This is rubbish. So you say, so and so your technique a bit unusual. Yeah. So again, you see, there are three levels of meanings to things, right? So you really want to ask yourself, okay, in a GP compre question, what am I being asked about here, right? A direct question is just the what, right? So what is the author saying? I just need to source and paraphrase. So that's level one, right? The same way that I would say, oh, the teacher just said that my method of studying is not typical. So I paraphrase unusual, right? Sometimes you will get questions that say, why does the author say this, right? Why does the author say that? You are your method of your method of work is unusual. Then you have to infer, right? Actually, what this person is trying to imply is that this situation is not good. Finally, right, The difficult questions in comprehension are generally about technique. So they will ask you things like, what is the irony here? So in that case, then that's harder. That's a level three question. It's meant to be difficult. So a good example, 2021, there was a question that said, 2021 was about fashion, okay? And the paragraph said that part of the problem with the fast fashion industry is that it pollutes water sources, right? So you use chemicals to dye or to process cloth, and then the chemical runoff runs into rivers and water sources, and then it screws them up, correct? So the question I think was, what does the author suggest is amiss when rivers turn yellow or pink? Right? So the word that is highlighted to students is the word amiss, right? What does the author suggest is amiss? So the first thing that you need to know is what does the word amiss mean? Correct? That's level one. At this point, some of you are probably thinking, crap, I don't know what the word amiss means. AMISS, right? Panic. Okay. Never mind, you don't know what this word means. That puts you behind people who do know what this word means, but you can still guess from the context, right? You know the paragraph is about pollution. You know that it's about dyeing or processing cloth and there's chemical runoff in the river. The river has turned bright yellow or bright pink. Therefore, the word amiss, at the very least, must suggest that something is. What do we think?
Missing.
No, not missing, right? So, okay, I mean that's a good strategy, right? Because you see, okay, can I guess from the word itself, right? But if you think about it, there's pollution in the water, the water has turned a funny color, there's all kinds of toxic additions. Amiss basically means something is wrong. Does that make sense? Okay. So this is the difficulty, right? So what is the author trying to say? That the use of the word amiss conveys that the water quality is being destroyed, being harmed, something is wrong with the water, something has gone wrong with the water quality because of the chemical dyes from the clothes making process, whatever it is. So it requires you to infer lah, right? If you don't know, of course, you see there are some students out there who have a better vocabulary. They already know what the word amiss is. And then congratulations, you just write down the answer and move on, right? But if you don't know, then you have to guess. Guess from the surrounding context, infer that the word amiss implies that something is wrong. Okay? It doesn't make sense to say that, hey, something is missing. Because actually, in this case, chemical dye has been added to the water, right? It's polluting the water. Yeah. So those are, yeah. That's it. That's pretty much it for, compre. What are the traps, right? Students guess wrong. Students panic. They're not able to guess. They get sort of locked into what kind of question is this? But yeah. What was the next question?
Summary.
Oh, that's right. That's right. That's right. Okay. So the gap between the O levels and the A levels is that at the O levels, you can get away with not paraphrasing, right? You can still lift here and there. At the A levels, you are not really allowed to lift, right? Unless it's really a very technical term, okay? More or less, I try and tell students, paraphrase as much as you can. A lot of students now, I know some of our listeners are thinking, crap, I'm dead, right? Like, I don't have a big vocabulary. How can I paraphrase? What I tell my students is, actually, you don't have to have a big vocabulary to still do well at the summary. Because by the time that you get to junior college, have faith, right? The fact that you got into JC alone, right, is probably a good sign for your ability to have enough language. Okay, but What is difficult about it is that students get locked into the structure of the sentence and they don't think about what other words they can use if they rearrange the sentence as a whole. So one thing that I tell students is you don't have this sense that you need to change the words one by one, right? This sort of one by one process. Sometimes it works, but if you get stuck, then try and move away from that. Ask yourself, if I were explaining this to a much younger student or like, my baby cousin, how would I explain this, right? Capturing meaning is more important. So I give you a concrete example again. My classes were doing a summary on burnout, right? Like we've all heard of burnout. Some of us are maybe a little bit burnt out ourselves. The summary was on burnout. The original phrase was, burnout can be defined as physical and mental exhaustion. Okay. Oh, did I just freeze? Okay, no, it's okay. Wait, I'm gonna grab my charger. Hold on.
One.
Wow. Okay, so what was I saying? The passage was on burnout. The original phrase was burnout is defined as physical and mental exhaustion. Okay, so what you need to paraphrase is physical and mental exhaustion, right? I put you on the spot, Daryl. You try and paraphrase physical and mental.
Burnt out physically, I feel, is like lack of sleep kind. Like, wow, my body cannot take it. Yeah. Mental, I think it's like more stress and like no more mental capacity to do things. So
Okay, but you
like
cannot
that's
use
how I would.
mental capacity. You cannot use the word mental again. Try.
Like I think maybe I'll use the word stress or like o
Okay.
over capacity. You see why I
Okay.
struggled with my GP last time?
I see, I see, I see, I see, I see. Okay. Wait, but we think also about the word exhaustion. What does it mean to be exhausted? What's a good paraphrase for exhausted?
Very tired.
Yes, exactly. Okay, very good, very good, very good. Correct. Okay, so the first problem that a lot of students have is that when they paraphrase exhausted, they just say tired. But what I really want is extremely tired, very tired, right? Because I want you to capture the intensity of exhausted, right? Exhaustion is more than just normal tiredness. So when you say very tired, I was like, yay, perfect. Okay, now for okay, but you see, right? You're thinking, okay, how can I paraphrase? Burnout means that I am something, something very tired, right? Physically and mentally. So it's a good approach, right? You ask yourself, okay, what does it mean to be physically exhausted? And interestingly, actually, part of the answer is already there, right? When you were saying that just now, you said, oh, my body is like completely like broken down, et cetera, right? That's correct. So what is the, you have your body and then the noun form for mental, what is it? Your body and your?
Mine, right?
Yes, exactly. Perfect, right? Okay, so now all you have to do is rearrange the sentence, right? So burnout is defined by physical and mental exhaustion. Burnout happens when your body and mind are worn out or very tired. Do you see? So actually, nobody doesn't know body, mind, very tired. You don't need a very big vocabulary to produce that sentence. But because it requires some rearrangement of the sentence structure, because most students are sort of thinking, okay, right, physically and mentally exhausted, then they get kind of stuck, and then they usually choose the wrong word, like, okay, I'm very stressed, right? Doesn't quite count. Does that make sense? So that rearrangement of sentence is something that I try and get my students to do to practice. Of course, you may ask, is there a sort of word-to-word equivalent? Yes, there is. So you would say burnout means that we are. So instead of physically and mentally, you say physiologically and psychologically worn out. But you see, physiologically, psychologically, I think most students know, but physiologically is the big vocab word, right? That most students may not have. But as I said, the point is, if you don't have this big vocab word, it's fine. You can paraphrase physically and mentally as my mind and body are very tired. So that's the thing for summary. I always tell students, please take a step back, write naturally, explain naturally, trust that actually you have 90% of the vocabulary necessary to do well in the summary. Really, 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 really. You don't need to go and memorize vocabulary lists, right? It's not going to help you. Because in linguistics, because I work in translation as well, right? In linguistics, in translation, there's a difference between what we call active vocabulary and passive vocabulary. Actually, it should be the other way around. Passive vocabulary is bigger, active vocabulary is smaller. Meaning, passive vocabulary are the kinds of words where if I say, you will recognize, but you are not very capable of using them actively. So draw from your active vocabulary. Maybe some of you actually knew the word physiological. Maybe you go to a physiotherapist. You're like, ah, I recognize that word. But you see, physiological is in your passive vocabulary. It's not going to emerge in an exam when you're stressed and under pressure. So in an exam under pressure, ask yourself, what is the natural way that I can phrase it? My mind and body are worn out. Mind and body is definitely in your active vocabulary. If mind and body is not in your active vocabulary, something is wrong. Okay? Sweet. So that's for the AQ. Write naturally, draw from your active vocabulary, try and take a step back, rearrange the sentence, explain it.
Wow, I
Cool.
mean, I never really approached it from that lens of like, what is active versus passive vocab? I mean, for me, vocab was just vocab, but maybe not words that we commonly use, and therefore we don't commonly think of. I mean, this has been an amazing podcast. I mean, I wish I was a student and had insights like this. But maybe just to sum it all up, right, Joey, if we could just, for a student like me in the past, whereby I was scoring a D and an E and I felt so helpless about GP. What is like one advice you give them in order to get started on their next baby step? So what do they need to do right now if even if they're J1 or J2, what's the first thing you encourage them to do?
For paper one, go and collate, go and buy the 10-year series and collate every question from the topic that you want to study and start by picking out the common ideas. Ideally, then take it to somebody who can confirm with you that you have the correct common ideas, right? So somebody who can tell you, okay, look, yes, these are the major groupings, these are the major ideas, right? Because frankly, a lot of schools will say read more, read the newspaper, learn more information. But you need to ask yourself, what am I learning it for, right? Anytime you read the newspaper, anytime you study a topic, you need to ask yourself, the information I'm learning should help me answer some of these questions. So if you can have the sort of meta question, right? You've looked at all the questions in the past, you understand what are these questions all trying to aim for. Then, when you study, you will be able to ask yourself, okay, this thing that I'm learning now, how can I use it? How can I use it for paper one? So that's the first thing for paper one. Go and look at the previous year's 10 years worth of questions. Go and look at your previous school papers or whatever, right? You can do this on your own. Of course, students who come to class, I give them the list and say, okay, now you all think about it lah, right? But you don't technically need me to do that for you, right? You can go and buy the 10-year series at Popular yourself. The other thing is, but importantly, I think this is where either come to class or go to your school teacher or ask a senior who's very good at GP, find someone to check that the list that your understanding of the key issues is correct before you then go off to try and make essay plans and study. So that's for paper one. Paper two, one thing that I do tell students is actually, I think students don't do this enough, but you should redo papers. Okay. By which I mean, imagine you do a compre, okay, and then the first time it comes out totally crap, right? You kind of messed it up, right? Give it some time, let it fade from your memory, right? And then I don't know, photocopy and blank it all out and do it again. Because if the second time round you are still making exactly the same errors, Then something more fundamental is the problem. You know what I mean? Right? You either didn't understand something about the passage, or you are still not reading the question correctly. In which case, then again, you may want to seek help, right? From school teacher, from tuition teacher, get a diagnosis, ask them, you know, what am I doing wrong? Because a lot of students, when they come to me in JC 2 year especially, they will say, oh, actually, I've been doing a lot of practice papers. But you see, if no one ever tells you this is the error type that you are making, you will continually do practice paper after practice paper and just make the same error practice paper after practice paper. Because the truth is, for paper two, you will never see that practice paper again, right? So yeah, try this diagnostic thing on yourself. You go back and dig up a paper that maybe you did for school or something and you did poorly at it. Do it again. All right. If you improve the second time, great, right? It suggests that, hey, you know, you are more familiar with the questions now. If you still screw it up, then check your teacher. Check your teacher. Come to class, ask a senior, where am I going wrong, right? Why do I keep making this mistake?
I
Very
mean, for sure,
actionable.
Zui. Yeah, thank you so much for your time today. I think for students, JC students especially tuning in, I really hope that you guys have a deeper insight on how to do well for GP. It's not one of those subjects that you go like, oh, it's just language and I can just wing it and I'll do well. I think you really need to dedicate time to understand the requirements of both paper one and paper two, including the different components in paper two as well. So, Zui, thank you so much for your time. For those of you who enjoyed today's podcast, remember to subscribe or follow us on our different platforms, whether it's Spotify or YouTube. And we look forward to bringing you even more podcasts in the future. Goodbye,
This is
everyone.
so cute. It's the like, subscribe, and share.
I got to do it, man.
Wow.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, goodbye.